Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Conan. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
Today we're going to talk to Eve Engler some about an article he wrote called Militarism on Rise in Conservative Canada. What do you know? And then at the halfway point, we're going to talk to Rick Rozoff. You might see him on RT.com as a commentator. He writes for Global Research and is a very brilliant man. And of course, he's a proprietor, I'm going to call him, of StopNATO.com. And now there's a life project. Try that. But we're going to talk to him about why it's all so tricky. But it's a brilliant article he reprinted in the Herald, Scottish Herald, on the NATO issue and Scottish nationalism. It's very, very bright and very worrying, you might say. If anybody here has any ideas about being an independent country anytime soon, you can forget the commercials about the War of 1812. That was 200 years ago. And since then, we were, as I understand it, our team plays in the American League. As I say, we'll be speaking to Eve Engler. I want to say right off the top, there's a big event coming up. There's going to be a tribunal in Toronto, and it's scheduled for September 21 through the 23rd. And it's going to be a people's tribunal, an assembly on the Cuban Five. And there's going to be people here from all over the world, including very prominent individuals. Cindy Sheehan is going to be part of it, and the actor Danny Glover, and many other outstanding figures, but people who've had the courage to speak out on this really egregious issue of the Cuban Five. And I'm going to give you more details about this later on, but I want you to know it's coming up on the September 21 and 23rd, and we'll be hosting various individuals who are associated with this great project. I think joining us now is Eve Engler. Are you there, Eve?
How's it going, Phil?
Very good. Eve, you wrote an important article here that I hope everybody is going to see. It's published in iPolitics.ca. It was on July 27, and the title is Militarism on Rise in Conservative Canada. And it's interesting. You're pretty much in the vanguard on this. People seem to be going along with this. But describe what has happened under Harper that is worrying to you.
Well, I mean, the starting point for the article was the fact that about a month ago, the head of the Canadian military said in an interview to Canadian press, basically said the troops want another war, and they're ready to go. They're just asking me where is our next mission, and we want to go to war. And that passed without comment, which I think is very troubling in the fact that no political leaders, no opposition officials, obviously no one from the government said, hey, the head of the military shouldn't be publicly calling for another war.
Yeah, he sounds like a private rather than a general, doesn't he? I mean, you train the – everybody's – I went through this boot camp, et cetera. Of course you want to go to war, but what do you know? I mean, you know, they train you, they get you all set. You have this kind of weapon, you have that kind of. You really want to use them, but it's basically, you know, nothing to do with policy. It's just having the guy in some kind of shape. But he's sounding like a guy in boot camp.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think it's not you know, it's not surprising that a leading military official at one level would want to go to war. I mean, that's as you pointed out. That's what you train to do, and that's the job. What's disturbing is the fact that the head of the army can say that publicly, says that publicly, and there's no backlash, and the fact that he feels comfortable to say that publicly, which is where you get to the question of what the conservatives have done over the past handful of years in terms of militarizing Canadian society. And, you know, by increasing the military budget from about $15 billion when they entered to about $23 billion, by increasing the number of troops, by, you know, setting up bases in seven different countries around the world. To the plan that I'm sure people are familiar with, that to have bases set up in basically sort of strategic points all around the world, so Canada can, in the words of Peter McKay, can, you know, better react to the next Haiti or Libya situation.
Yes.
You're setting it, as well as a huge cultural component. Mm-hmm. They're basically setting up for more militarism, and are you know, whether they directly ask the Walter Nattingsink, the head of the army, to make that comment publicly, or he just felt comfortable to do it.
Yes.
Because of what the Conservatives have laid out, it doesn't really matter either way, but it's a very disturbing sign.
But this is Eve Engler, author of Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt, a terrific, I'd say brilliant new book. And Eve, you know, there's other language being introduced that should give every Canadian pause, I would think. The minister, Mr. McKay, says he speaks of expeditionary troops. And you mentioned that, of course, they're all quite proud of themselves about Libya and elsewhere. But that is colonial work under the old system, right? Expeditionary troops. If you're defending Canada, Canada is pretty easy to find on a map. And it's not in Afghanistan, and it's not in the Middle East, and we're not the masters of the situation. We're just going along, right?
Going along, and in the case of Libya, going along at a pretty high rate, pretty active. Yeah,
pound
role,
for pound, but plane for plane. Is that what the Prime Minister said?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. That Canada's the Canadian troops are the best, but I don't mean just at that level. I mean just at the level of how engaged, how many bombs drop, Canadian fighter jets in Libya doing the dirtiest work, because it was a Canadian general in charge of all of the operations, and a number of countries that were under the Canadian, their fighter jets were under Canadian commander. They had they had restrictions on where they could drop bombs, whereas the Canadian fighter jets were dropping bombs everywhere. It's reported that they were hovering overhead when Gaddafi was killed. They didn't have confirmation of whether they dropped bombs. Of course, there was.
Well, they were involved in targeting him, I gather. I mean, there seems to be no illusions about that, that he was being. That was a NATO exercise, the taking out of the man personally.
Exactly, and there was obviously serious, huge number of people that were killed in that, both by the dropping of the bombs and then assassinations on the ground. So Canada's heavily involved in that, and we just got this report a couple days ago that they've begun to spend $1 billion on armed unmanned vehicles, drones. And that's something that the military began thinking about planning in the midst of the bombing of Libya. And now that's been, Ottawa Citizen had a front page article about that a couple of days ago. So that's not, as you put it, Canada is pretty clear on a map. And the point of these drones, while they mention that there's going to be a potential domestic role, the real point of the drones, of course, are for expeditionary operations.
Yeah, I'm so struck by that word, because having read a few things, Kipling and others, expedition and expeditionary forces, that was the old 19th century adventure stuff. We're going to go out and straighten out the dark people.
Yeah, and if you go back in the history of Canadian foreign policy, Canada was probably at a slightly lesser rate, but was, you know, involved in many of those straightening out of the brown people going back a century. Infamous role of Canadian military commander in the Congo, Canadian troops in the Boer War from 1898 to 1902, where tens of thousands of Boer women and children were put into concentration camps, and I think it's 20,000 or more Boer women and children that were killed in that. So this isn't something new.
Yes, and the Mahdi was drugged behind a horse through the streets to punish him for having had the temerity to oppose British rule of Sudan.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, Canadian troops were sent there to Sudan in 1885 in response to that. So this isn't something that's new. in terms of the, if you go back in terms of the, a long vision of version of Canadian foreign policy history, what it is I think in the short to medium term, it is a new phase or it's a significantly more aggressive phase than in the past. If you take the last 25, 30 years of Canadian foreign policy, the Conservatives have gotten, have ramped up the militarism. I think what happened to a large extent, you know, the Korean War was something that Canada was involved with, 27,000 Canadian troops, incredibly bloody affair. Yes. But I, and Canada was not, you know, militarily directly involved in Vietnam, involved in a whole series of other ways. But I think there was a sort of a civilizing effect that the anti-war movements, the Latin America, the Central American solidarity movements, there was sort of a civilizing effect on Canadian foreign policy. And what we have, what we're seeing sort of post 9/11, and the Conservatives are really ramping that up, is a sort of step back in the the wrong direction, if you like.
I would definitely agree with you. This is Eve Engler. He's the author of Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping. The Truth May Hurt, and it certainly, well, I don't know if it hurts. It certainly amuses. It's a great book. And Eve, and in conclusion here, I want to make sure I highlight something. We, last week on the show here, we recalled that it was the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We spoke of the both. Now, in your book, I seem to recall, I think it was you, who pointed out that Mackenzie King wrote something in his diary about the bombing of Japan, if I've got it right. What did he have to say about that?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't been able to find the quote in the last 2 seconds while on the phone here. But
sorry to do that to you.
he said explicitly in his biography, and this is there's a sanitized version of the biography, and then there's the real biography, and the one that has his actual biography. He says that he was happy that the atomic bombs were dropped on Asian peoples and not on the white races of Europe. Mm. And he pretty explicitly racist
and political. His point being, I guess, that we might have a problem explaining killing white people, but not Asians.
Exactly. And it's also important to note that Canada wasn't without complicity, because this isn't just him commenting afterwards. Canadian Minister C.D. Howe, the second most powerful minister in Mackenzie King's government, he sat on the body with British and American officials that planned to discuss dropping the bomb, and he, we don't have record of what he said in the meeting, but we have no record of him dissenting. So as the pointed out in the book Orient in Canada that came out in 2011, a very good book. Presumably, C.D. Howe okayed the dropping of the bombs, as well as, of course, the Canada's uranium and role in you know, the sort of the production of the weapons.
Found a way to profit from making bombs. This is Eve Engler. He's the author of Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt, and in the article Militarism on Rise in Conservative Canada. And you can find that in ipolitics.ca of July 27, 2012. Eve Engler, thank you very, very much for the time.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
Okay, bye-bye. Yeah. You're listening to Sailor Report. It's CIUT. It's 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and and I left something out. Oh, yes, taylor-report.com. You can go and find interviews such as the one we've just done with Eve Engler and keep up with that. There's some, I think we should say some things here. We're in about 15 minutes, we're going to speak to Rick Rosoff, but I want to call attention to some matters. I don't know, Phil, if you were struck by this. I'm really sorry. I neglected to ask his thoughts. But the final ceremony, did you see the final ceremony of the Olympics?
I did not. I just decided I was going to boycott England. That was...
Oh, you just... You are part so Irish.
I didn't watch. 4 years ago, I watched assiduously, but I just... I just couldn't watch. And actually, you know, when Cameron was a smart aleck with Romney, and I mean, how hard is it to be a smart aleck with somebody as dumb as Romney? But when he made that crack about, you know, you can put on Olympics in the middle of nowhere, but we're doing it in London, I thought, well, boy, what an arrogant SOB.
Yeah, well, of course, if you have two SOBs, it's kind of hard to, you know, you say, I'm not, for once, the proverb applies, I don't have a dog in that fight. Maybe. I mean, I'm all for Salt Lake City, but as a city. There was a moment, and I don't know if I'm alone in this, but one of the, as they began, they had a law of quite a pageant. I'm being nice. A pageant. And they had the Tower of Big Ben, and the top opened, and out popped Winston Churchill with a cigar, which is, you know, you want the kiddies to see a guy with a cigar. And they tell me that he was spouting Shakespeare, although I must say I just saw a man who looked crazy, which did appear to be Churchill. And I didn't know if that was satire, but it apparently didn't mean it as satire. It really gave me pause, you know. As Eve pointed out, you know, we're looking at a period here with post-British Empire domination. As I used to say, I mean, there was a time when the sun did not set, as they were happy to say, on the British Empire. And Churchill said, very memorably, that he did not intend to preside over the dissolution of that empire. Because he was told at the end of World War II, listen, Winston, you can't keep this show going. I mean, you know, because we just had a war about this. And there was an issue called the self-determination of nations and respect, and which was all new to the British ruling class. So Churchill embodied for a while, at least he took that stance, being a hypocrite. He actually did help preside over it. But I was wondering why everybody is so enthusiastic. There had to be countries there who, all of whom, many, like Kenya for sure, India, let's say Pakistan, let's say a number.
Iraq. The victim of the first chemical warfare.
Chemical bomb that dropped on Iraq.
That Churchill dropped on them, yes.
Yeah. So, and out pops this guy, and he's the center of the story. And nobody has a problem with that. I mean, well, at least certainly none of the blah-blah people who are paid to like everything. But what I was asking, you know, we had the Beijing Olympics, and, you know, there is a comparison. And there was no attempt to put the great figure Mao Zedong, who is the, whether people here like him or do not like him, for whatever their reasons might be, he happened to have been an ally of ours in World War II. One of the reasons we like to say, you know, we won the war, we had allies. But Canada didn't win that by itself. Oh, I'm getting confused. America didn't win it by itself. Oh, I'm getting confused. The British didn't win it by themselves. No, there was China. And the Chinese did not see fit to push that figure to the front, which they had every reason if they wanted. I mean, national pride. It's rare that the national hero of any country is liked by other countries because they have different memories. And I don't want to enter that dispute, but the fact is that the British chose to go with the figure of Winston Churchill as though he was somehow a friend of the people of Kenya, a friend of the people of Iraq. So, I mean, that was kind of a tin ear, I might say, for people who were celebrating their music. They didn't politically. I don't know where that came from.
But isn't even there a domestic message there? Well, whoever cheers for Churchill in Britain now, you won't find him in Scotland, Wales, or Ireland. You know, so I mean, it's almost like an internal message as well to the British people. It's like we're the English and we run this place. You know, it's
this is our show.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll cry if I want to, and I'll do whatever else. I thought there was an extraordinary Canadian athlete who unfortunately showed tremendous, I'd say, Olympic spirit and personal courage and eloquence. There's a runner from the 4x100 relay team who stepped on the line, and he said, within minutes of it happening, he said, the rules are unforgiving. It was me that did that. I'm sorry. I apologize to my teammates, and it was my fault. And he had to get an Olympic medal for Olympic character, because meanwhile, all over the place, there's whining and moaning, And, you know, the Americans got shut out of boxing. I said on this program last week, if you want to see an indication that there is something really seriously wrong in the contemporary America, it's the absence of Americans in the boxing, where, by the way, African Americans have been particularly proficient. None of them made the finals. No American boxer for the first time in history. And if I say that, you say, well, and that means, think about Cassius, a man named Cassius Clay, later Muhammad Ali, or think of George Foreman or of Joe Frazier and the great Sugar Ray Leonard. All those fighters were Olympic fighters. I don't think Frazier, by the way, won. I think that the Cubans beat him. The greatest boxer in Olympic boxing history is the Cuban, Teofilo Stevenson. But just as an indication of a serious problem. Now, but look how it reflected itself further. I'm reminding you of the character of that Canadian sprinter. The Americans were given the privilege, NBC, of sitting at ringside with their commentators. And, you know, this is amateur boxing, so there's a problem. The judges are sitting there. So at a certain point, the Olympic officials had to go to the NBC commentators, one of whom is Teddy Atlas, who has always been much too loud whenever he'd been. And Teddy Atlas was asked, or told them, they were told, you're going to have to move out of the area because your talk is upsetting and confusing the judges. It's disturbing. And they have to judge these fights. So NBC said no, they wouldn't move. And then they said, "But you will have to go back over it with the other media because your privileged spot here is now, you know, taken. You have to be with the other media." They said, "No, we'll leave because there are no American fighters there anyway." So, you know, I'd say here's a good chance, President Obama, to tell the country you have to grow up. This is an international competition, and you don't own the darn thing. It doesn't belong to you. And show a little respect. Instead, they say, oh, there's no American fighters. We're gone. By the way, there are fighters there. Are you interested in fighting or not? You better study them because they're the champions now. Incidentally, you know who got the most medals? Great Britain, which is odd because the BBC also got out of line and started, every time they didn't get a medal, apparently the BBC indicated they thought someone had been bribed. And they're under a sanction at the moment for having somebody in their outfits talking like that. So it's interesting how the Olympics, you know, they're supposed to be all very sporting.
Well, there was some whining from the Canadians, too, over the women's soccer. I mean, that was a little unseemly. But they accused the referee of having taken a bribe, you know.
Did they say bribe? I thought they seemed to be corrupt.
She said, you should be wearing the American jersey. I mean, that's like saying... Yeah.
Okay, I agreed with that one, but nonetheless, no, I think I agree. People should not do that, and there is at the end of the day, you just have to kind of go with it. And now another incident came up, or is coming up, and that is the baiting of the Jamaicans for being champions. And you have a guy running for the Americans who was out for 4 years on a sanction doping. That's Mr. Gatlin. He's walking around like he has nothing, you know, like he never did time. I'd say, whoa, 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 slow down. and for people to talk about them, about the Jamaicans, this is absurd. But I do like it in one sense. When they say that, okay, you beat us in the 4x100, which is hard to do. Americans are always, they think they own that. And then the 100 meters, you beat us at that, and you beat us at the 200. So you must be using dope, although there's no evidence. Now, I like the second point in that they seem to be saying that Jamaican science is superior to American science. I think that's possible. I think maybe the Jamaicans are more advanced. And so they have you both ways. They're apparently scientifically more advanced than you were, and they beat you at the race. So that's good. And incidentally, two American sprinters showed up at a tent there where for a little soiree that the big outfits, Nike and others, hold, with a guy who's been banned for 10 years for providing dope, not just to anybody, but to his own wife. And two of these American sprinters were hanging with him, as they say. And when they were asked, why did you do that? I refer you, by the way, to letsrun.com. Go to letsrun.com. And you will see their commentary. But they asked him, well, why did you do that? And they said, oh, he's a friend, you know, and we don't turn on our friends. Well, you are at an Olympic event representing your country, and a man who's been busted, who was an agent and a doper for 10 years, he's lost 10 years. You could say to him, hey, look, I got nothing against you personally, but, you know, let's respect the game. But no, they turned it into, oh, he's my friend. Well, you know, I remember two American spinners who came to visit Charles Francis here in Toronto. And they said, why did they come to see him? He was busted. Oh, he's a friend. We just came for his advice. He's a brilliant guy. A year later, both of them were busted with dope. That would be Marion Jones and Tim Montgomery. Come on. You know, I agree with LessRun.com. Don't pull our leg here, you know. And for the Americans, they better get off their high horse. If that guy is allowed to hang around American Olympic, these are both gold medalists, by the way. One's 110-meter hurdles. I forget the other one. They're going to hang around with him. You follow the book of Matthew. Look into the mote in your own eye before talking about other people. I don't, as far as I'm concerned, if that goes on, forget it. No one should hear a complaint from the Americans because they tolerate Olympic spinners saying, oh, that guy's my friend. And he's at an Olympic event. I just thought I'd go over and, you know, come on. I mean, you're pulling my leg. I remind you again, the People's Tribunal and Assembly on the Cuban Five is coming on September 21st and 23rd. And there's going to be a number of really prominent individuals who are – it's basically going to be a hearing into the treatment of the Cuban Five. And it's going to examine the evidence of U.S. manipulation of the trials of the five and of their improper treatment of the five and their families. And that's going to be September 21, 23rd. And here's the site. Face the Five. Pardon me. Boy, I got to look at, make sure I get this. I'm going to misread it. I'm going to have to find it and make sure I get it right. Free the not to write their own notes.
Free
the five, and the five is a numeral. Free the Five People's Tribunal. Free the Five People's Tribunal, and the five is the number five. But otherwise, it's Free the Five People's Tribunal .org. Go there for all your information, and make sure that plan to attend. As I mentioned already, the actor Danny Glover is going to be there. Cindy Sheehan will be there, and there will be a number of individuals from around the world who played a prominent part. We'll be mentioning their names, and we'll be talking to people about this in later programs. And I want to mention that also that Sandra Roosh informs us that GazaArc.org is bringing a speaker, Greta Berlin, and she's going to be here on September, she'll be here September 28 and 29, promoting her new book, Freedom Sailors, and as well as speaking about the work of GazaArc.org. And GazaArc is Gaza and an arc as one word, so you have two A's there, .org. That's going to be September 28 at Beth Sadoun. Greta Berlin does a lot of work with Gaza, and her book is Freedom Sailors, and you can get that freedomsailors.com. And so we're going to take a break. I just discovered that. I don't know what that signal means. And this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and we'll be back in a moment.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back, just like I warned you. And we hope to have Rick Rosa shortly. We have other matters. I want to mention that the government is going to great pains to fictionalize the War of 1812 when Britain and America went to war, and then, as a writer in the Globe and Mail pointed out, It was a war between it was a three-cornered war. Britain was leading an effort against the French. The Americans wished to be neutral and try to behave as neutrals. However, the British decided to take American sailors and British sailors, so previous British sailors, off American ships. They only took 6,000 of them. I don't know how many it would take for you to get angry if you were running and leading a country that wishes to be neutral, losing 6,000 sailors over. We're talking about an 8-10 year span. This war went on. And the Americans were told they could not enter any ports in Europe without first stopping at the British port, et cetera. So they refused that. And it led to a confrontation and a war. For some reason, there's been a mad attempt here to fictionalize the event and using Hollywood techniques, et cetera, to talk about, we stood off the Americans and we. Well, yes, the British Army, if you like them, good, and you think they were right, good, that's fine, but let's not get confused. Canada did not exist, did not participate in the peace treaty, not a single individual from here was represented, and neither did they complain since they didn't have a country and it wasn't an issue. And, of course, the pictures that we see, if you've seen it, it is amazing and perverse, actually. They put up the picture of a Hollywood representation of Tecumseh. Now, there's a gentleman, a leader and fighter and et cetera. His country, as far as he knew, he was in an alliance. He's not a Canadian, by the way, and nor is he British. And he thought he was in an alliance. The way this commercial is run is to make it utterly humiliating to the native, as in my opinion, the native cause of the day, as represented by Tecumseh. And I should also say the native cause of the day was also quite confused, because there were those who did not agree to make an alliance with the British. There were people like another leader in the same region of Ohio named Tahe, who had he said we should stay out of this war because we can only lose, so we should just, not. But others said, no, this is our best chance to make an alliance with the British. So when people speak of, well, we went and we defended, well, there's your ally, Tecumseh, waiting for you to help him defend his country. He lost it, the entire thing, the Ohio Valley, Michigan, Indiana, et cetera, all of it gone. And that was what he was fighting for. He never said, well, at least we've got Canada. That never occurred to him. It's absurd, and particularly since he lost his life. And in the end, the cause from the point of view of Native Americans was, as represented by his leadership, was smashed. And they were not represented at the meeting in Europe to end the war. Not represented. The British had made a promise. Do you like Brock? He made a promise. Well, he didn't keep it. It is somewhat galling. But today is also, you might want to know, it's the anniversary of the first, since people want to embrace the war, there's a proverb, he who says A must also say B. In 2 days will be the anniversary of the massacre at Fort Dearborn, which is now called Chicago. And the commander of the American forces, a man named General Hull, former governor, Hull, when he realized that the situation was very bad from the point of view of the American forces, because, as he said, Lake Erie was under the British control, and he felt that they were trapped. There was a surrender at Fort, I'm going to call it McMilliac. There was always trouble of how to McMilliac. I'm going to do that. At any rate, there was a surrender there. The commanding officer did not know there was a war on. The British forces arrived with some Native allies, and the British commander said to them, if you don't surrender, we can't control our Native allies, so you might be massacred. So I'm suggesting you surrender. The Americans said, fine, I surrender. So then they put them in boats, and they went down the lake to Detroit. And when Hull learned that they had surrendered, he thought the game was up in terms of being able to defend. So he sent a message to Fort Dearborn, which is a small fort at that time, and he said, evacuate that fort. You have allies there, native allies. Ask them to escort you, but give up that fort. This is, by the way, before all these dramatic confrontations between Brock and Tecumseh and had the great showdown with the Americans at Detroit. He had already made the decision. He'd already sent the word to the commander at Dearborn, okay, evacuate. Well, the evacuation didn't come off so nicely. They told the allies of the British, at this point, the Potawatomi, they said, we're going to leave. The Potawatomi said, we want the guns and we want the other things. And he said, I can't do that. I've got orders. I've already, we are going to evacuate. We're not resisting. We're leaving. And they had sent someone from Fort Wayne to assist the evacuation. Well, they got a mile and a half from the fort, and they were attacked by British allies, who then massacred them, women and children. The ones they didn't massacre, they took as prisoners, and they sold them to the British as a deal, part of the deal. The British then delivered them to Detroit, which they had subsequently captured. At any rate, so put that on your list of things done. That was a massacre. And then at Detroit, I saved the remarks of the great General Brock. He said something about his allies, which I think is outrageous. He said he sent a message, and people kind of chuckle about this. They think it's funny. He sent a message to the commander Hull at Detroit, and he said, it is far from my intention to join in a war of extermination, but my Indian allies will be beyond my control the moment the contest commences. So he's threatening terror. That's all that is. And he's also saying that there's something subhuman, something about the natives. To Tecumseh's credit, it's said about him that he was not one to massacre. He didn't. He had, like other people, principles of warfare and whatnot. So here, Brock is just having a little game because they seem to see the native ally as a kind of terror threat. I'm saying that they said that Tecumseh didn't sign the statement, I'll be out of control. This is someone speaking in his behalf. Now, Hull is mocked by the Americans and by the British because he surrendered. I've thought about this, and I didn't. I never thought, well, why not? I mean, what is the point? He was short on supply. He was terribly exposed. And why have people, women and children, were there in the fort? Why die about it? You have superior forces. Let's be an end to it. And then it's advertised, well, that was a tremendous victory. I suppose in some sense it is. He surrendered. 1 year later, of course, the American forces returned, took over the fort, and then pursued the British commander, who made exactly the same decision. General Proctor, when he realized that now Erie was no longer a British lake, but had become an American lake, which meant all the advantage in speed and coordination of forces. If you're on the lake, it's like being on a highway. If you have to go through the woods, that's a lot of work. But if you are on the lake, you're there. It's very quick. So the Americans' forces had captured Lake Erie in October of 1813. And then Proctor made the same decision Hull did, except, well, one difference. He said, I'm out of here. And he took off to get to Burlington. I don't blame him, because he wanted to preserve his troops. He's not an idiot. But he chose to make one brief stand on the Thames River, where poor Tecumseh was killed, and that proved to be terribly. So all that happened there was kind of an exercise in naval power. But people want to turn this into, you know, drums and marching and salutes and gunfire, and it's just ridiculous. We'll talk more about the War of 1812, but today is would be you can start celebrating the massacre that took place at Fort Dearborn. We're going to take a brief break, I think, and because we need to, I think we have a problem perhaps in locating our guests. So we'll be. And we're back. This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And by golly, lo and behold, and with our apologies, we have Rick Rozoff. How are you, Rick?
With your apologies, you have Rick Rozoff.
Yeah. We're really sorry about this. No.
Hello.
Yes. Well, that's how humble we are. Rick has a tremendous website, stopnato.com. And I've already said, Rick, that talking about taking on a project, Stop NATO, it couldn't be more important than now, stopnato.com, and it's his Rick Rozoff. I want to ask you, start with this. You published today a brilliant piece by a man named Ian Bell of the Scotland Herald. This is a very poignant matter for Canadians to think about because we have a lot of issues here about Canadian independence and sometimes Quebec independence. As a matter of fact, the people of Quebec often we have a strong nationalist movement, and they talk about the Scottish movement. They're kind of fraternal. But Ian Bell put his finger on a problem here, and that is with the Scottish National Party and Scots as a people have to contemplate where they fit in NATO and what is NATO. And I guess the phrase I want to start with, he says, if you're with NATO, it is a basically, it's servitude. That is, you have to submit to being, it's their policy, not your policy, right?
That's absolutely the case.
And we've spoken to this other matter. He says, raises the specter, if you're with NATO, you are also a nuclear power. That NATO, and he quotes them, says it's a nuclear alliance. And so Canadians need to be reminded of that, right? What is that? How do they get where people who think they don't have a bomb actually do have a bomb?
Yeah, that's correct. And the author you cite, Ian Bell in the Herald, mentions what's called alternately either nuclear sharing or burden sharing between the United States and its NATO allies, at least in Europe. I mean, I don't know what sort of arrangement they may have with Canada and Greenland. Greenland through Denmark, of course, being its being part of Denmark and Denmark being a founding member of NATO. But what Bell mentions is there are five countries in Europe that are still saddled by the nuclear sharing arrangement with the U.S. They're Germany, Italy, Belgium, Netherlands, and Turkey. Turkey most ominously, Phil, because it's a country that borders, as we know, Iran, Syria, and Iraq. And the United States has an estimated 90 B-61 tactical bombs at the Inchirlik base. Mm-hmm. And Turkey. But the point that the Scottish writer is making is that it is an obligation for every NATO member to, pretty much at the diktat of the United States, to house U.S. nuclear weapons. The nuclear sharing arrangement is even more dangerous, though, because it mandates that bombers or multi-role warplanes from the host nations deliver, tactical nuclear weapons, meaning that in the case of, let's say, an escalated regional conflict in the Middle East instigated by Turkey and then backed by their NATO allies, that Turkish bombers, strategic bombers, would deliver nuclear weapons, U.S. nuclear weapons. So that in the case of Scotland or Canada, the obligations are onerous, they're dangerous, they're generally, as you were intimating, not known to the general public. That Alex Salmond with the Scottish National Party and Angus Robertson, his defense advisor, have attempted a soft soap or sweeten the pill, if you will, for the Scottish people by not telling them what NATO members, the retention in NATO ultimately means.
Yes.
It's disingenuous at best, and it's really very dangerous.
Yeah. This is Rick Rozoff of StopNATO.com. He uses a vivid language as I think is very appropriate. He says you have to face the fact that you're going to dip your hands in the blood. If you're with NATO, apparently the Scottish Nationalist Party is trying to straddle the issue, but he said, no, can't be straddled.
Yeah, he used to be applauded for that degree of candor in the Western world right now, where to raise any substantive issue is to be accused of mauvais ton, I mean, bad taste or bad form. But he is, quite clear about what the issues are. I mean, his strong language is, inclusive of other statements. The opening sentence, for example, in his article of yesterday is, among those who can contemplate mass slaughter, the euphemism is sometimes the deadliest weapon of all. and he continues, with that degree of frankness and unequivocal language and concepts. Mm-hmm. That in fact are necessary to really discuss something as abhorrent and provocative and ultimately unsettling to world peace as is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Yeah, well, it's a terrific article. I really urge people to go to stopnato.com and read that. It's a very well written, and it, as you say, it confronts something which we there's so much. It certainly in Canadian politics involves non-discussion. It's like, well, there's a consensus. We won't bring this topic up.
Yeah, it's ungentlemanly to raise the most important issues in the world right now, those of war and peace. Those are of either stabilizing and developing the world situation or throwing it into bloody chaos. Mm-hmm. And to, have the lack of social tact, I suppose, to even mention these issues will get you ostracized right quickly. You know, even in many ostensibly progressive or alternative media.
Mm-hmm. Yes, too much so. I certainly here, you can just sense fear, and that's fear is very bad for the mind, and the people just who do the commenting and what have themselves in the progressive camp have agreed. Let's not talk about that, because they're afraid of it, literally afraid of where it might lead and the trouble it might get them into, I suppose.
In part, I think we also have to realize that increasingly what had been, if you will, the soft left or the independent left or the non-Marxist left, I don't know what term is apropos, in the United States you can't even talk about a social democratic left.
Yes.
Because there has been no independent social democratic formation to speak of since, the collapse of the Socialist Party, perhaps in the 20s and early 30s. Mm-hmm. But when most people think of left or progressive publications, for example, going back the last 20 or more years, you're talking about publications like The Nation, The Progressive, Mother Jones, In These Times, which are increasingly depending on foundation grants. Mm-hmm. and other monies that in the best case scenario, and in the most charitable explanation for it, realizing which side their bread is buttered on, they're hesitant to say anything when they have their funding cut off. Mm-hmm. And so that you have essentially blackmail even over what are, in theory at least, alternative news media.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's Rick Rozoff, and it's stopnato.com. And Rick, you raised, of course, the matter of Turkey, which is a NATO member, and here we are today. I'm seeing reports that the Free Syrian Army is claiming to have shot down a Syrian plane, but I'm also seeing reports that actually was the Turkish forces that did that. That kind of dispute might have some pretty ugly consequences, but what role, and you've reported on this at StopNATO.com, Hillary Clinton was just in Turkey. They were talking about no-fly zones. What is going on there in from your vantage point?
The Syrian government is winning the counterinsurgency struggle. That's fairly indisputable. First in Damascus, now in Aleppo, and with pockets of resistance remaining in the north near the Turkish border, where they're giving succor and sanctuary across the border and on the other side in Turkey. But it's evident at this point that the Western or combined Western Gulf monarchy strategy to wear down the Syrian government to through attrition, effectively, and to bring about you know, if not an uprising of people who simply want change because to continue, you know, after 17 months of, you know, the destabilization campaign that's been waged inside the country, you know, the fatigue factor and you know, the feeling that anything would be preferable to indefinite prolongation of this unstable situation, whatever it is the West had anticipated, has failed to materialize. And as a result, I think the the tendency is for the U.S. to U.S. and its allies to contemplate exactly what you're talking about. Maybe the unilateral enforcement of a no-fly zone or a safety corridor, humanitarian corridor, or something of the sort in the northern part of Syria near the Turkish border, where, as we recall, the, you know, the Turkish military has been conducting military exercises within only a couple of kilometers of the of Syria, the Syrian border. So that frustrated, as the West no doubt is, that they haven't succeeded in effecting a regime change or seeing the government overthrown in Damascus, they'll be emboldened to take increasingly more precarious steps, including ones such as the direct military confrontation or baiting of Syria, comparable to what happened earlier this summer when a Turkish jet was shot down after violating Syrian airspace.
It kind of reminded me of the old children's story of the wolf would huff and puff and blow your house down. I just wonder what you think. It seems to me there's kind of a quiet crisis unfolding here. It's going to be interesting to watch. Mr. Annan, who seems to be a rather poor employee, I mean, he takes a world-important job and then says he's frustrated. And the Americans seem to be happy that he pulled the plug on it publicly on what was a serious Security Council undertaking to bring peace. Now there's talk of replacing him. I get the impression maybe this might be an incremental improvement in the at least a commitment to a proper process.
But he'll be replaced by an Algerian diplomat, as we know, who speaks the language and is presumed to have some degree of impartiality. You know, unlike Annan, who on the surface conducted himself a little bit better than I would have expected, we have to recall that he was the handpicked puppet of the United States, not only to succeed, but to oust Boutros-Ghali.
Yeah, he was just like a hand puppet for Madeleine Albright, right? I mean, she spoke openly about that.
That's correct. She actually browbeat the other 14 members of the United Nations Security Council at that time. You know, two of the other permanent members, France and Britain, I'm sure didn't need much persuasion. Russia and China probably did. And then the 10 rotating members at the time. You know, the inside discussion, I'm sure you've read about this, a lot of your listeners know about it, is the other 14 members of the Security Council. At the time that Boutros-Ghali was deposed by Albright, were in favor of retaining him, as is the norm. I mean, the Secretary General generally gets a second term. I don't know of any precedents where he hasn't. And that he was deposed and replaced by somebody who had already proven his loyalty in the Balkans in the first instance to the United States NATO, Kofi Annan. You know, accounts for why he came in. And he was, you know, dutifully obedient and obsequious and helpful to
the U.S. By the way, he's very good at obsequious. He's a study.
Yeah, for those who remember their Harriet Beecher Stowe, I used to refer to him as Uncle Kofi.
Certainly, that's how he was viewed in Africa. In Kenya, I saw a newspaper when he got the job. They showed the UN building with him painting it, and it said USA.
Very good.
So they seemed to know who he was. We're speaking to Rick Rosoff, StopNATO.com. And, Rick, you were recently asked on RT.com, and we're always glad to see you there, by the way, on all your writing. But they wanted to know, is NATO laying low? Because you pointed out that NATO has had very little to say about Syria. Meanwhile, British and French forces are training in the East Mediterranean. And what's your analysis of why NATO has been kind of quiet, at least in their public demand?
That's an important point you raise, and I don't know. I can only suppose, but it's unlike the public relations profligate public relations campaigns that NATO's been promoting in recent years, for them to have kept as low a profile as, in fact, the alliance has. I would say probably now for the last 6 weeks. I was just looking at their main website today, and it's you know, almost nothing. And it's not that nothing is going on. It's simply that they're keeping an extremely low profile and keeping things under wraps. So I don't know what that signifies. Mm-hmm. If part of this is, you know, post-summit fatigue and they're getting their house in order again. And, of course, August is generally a slow month news-wise in Europe. Mm-hmm. If not in North America. This is very uncharacteristic, and I don't know to what extent they, in the event that NATO would become involved, say with an Article 5 invocation on behalf of Turkey, mm-hmm. which would succeed in provoking a military response, and you know, if in fact what you alluded to earlier, that Turkey may have shot down, mm-hmm. Syrian MiG aircraft, then this is certainly something that is inciting Syria to retaliate in some manner, which mm-hmm. then could be construed by Turkey, as a threat to its national security, which would entitle Turkey to go back to NATO headquarters and mm-hmm. Invoke Article 5 and get the entire alliance yeah. involved against Syria. So,
I wonder if I could raise it just in the last minute, a specter here. People should be reminded that Turkey and Greece, NATO members, once went to battle with each other. Would there be a consensus if Turkey were to suddenly pick a fight here? Would Greece, for example, like that?
The current Greek government most likely would go along with it, mm-hmm. I fear. Yeah, you're correct. I mean, they're not in recent years, but not in the not-too-distant past, Turkish and Greek warplanes almost shearing each other over the Adriatic, it was not an unusual sight. I mean, it happened frequently. And, of course, disputes over Cyprus persist with the increasingly, ominously, bellicose government of Erdogan in Ankara, who on August 5th, by the way, appeared, or at least a televised address appeared on August 5th, I don't know when it was taped, on Turkish television, where in one fell swoop, he threatened Syria, he threatened Iraq, called for the government of Nouri al-Maliki to be replaced, and then kind of second generation threatened Iran for both supporting
Just out of habit.
Of both Iraq and Syria, but at the same time, of course, with hostile policies towards Armenia, towards Cyprus, the so-called zero problems, with their neighbors policy of the current foreign minister of Turkey seems to have been turned into its reverse, which is problems with all its neighbors,
Plenty of problems. Rick Rosoff, you have a great site, stopnato.com. I apologize, it was my error today. I was separate from my computer and couldn't get your number in time.
I'm sorry.
But it's always edifying. We thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure to be on. Thanks, Phil.
Okay, bye-bye. It was Rick Rosoff, stopnato.com. And remember that People's Tribunal on the Cuban Five is coming up on September 21st, 23rd. And we will be talking more about that in the future. This is Phil Taylor for Phil Connellan and Carol for the Taylor Report. See you next week.